know about Dearborn, it's the home of the Ford Motor Company, but the part that may not be known across the country is that it's a completely segregated city. I think it still is today. I know when I was growing up, there were about 100,000 people in Dearborn, and it's right next to Detroit, which has a very high black population, but there were no blacks in Dearborn, or very few. I remember as a child growing up that a family had tried to buy a home in Dearborn. This is a large suburb, and it was reported in the local press how the neighbors vandalized the house and poured sugar in the gas tank, and the chief of police stood by and watched. We had a mayor, Orville L. Hubbard, LLB, who had a sign over the door of his office that said, "And he went about doing good." But he was reported in the newspapers as having commented that he wasn't 100% against colored people, he was 1,000% against them. Anyway, that was the city that I grew up in, and it was an interesting and a very nice place to grow up, except that I never had any chance as a boy really to meet anybody or have any conversations with anybody except people that looked something like myself. Until I went away to school, went to the University of Michigan, and then I began to recognize that there were quite a variety of colors of people in the world and people from a variety of backgrounds. But the real watershed came when my family and I moved out to Oakland, California, 6 years ago, and I began working as a faculty member at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley. San Francisco you will have heard of, and Oakland maybe, but it is a kind of a salad of every type of imaginable person, and some that you would never imagine. So it was a new experience for our family. To give you a little hint of what Oakland is like, our daughter Kathy needed to make her way into we wanted her to get into a particular junior high school that was a really good school, and we found out that there were quotas, and the quotas were all designed to represent different ethnic groups, and as I recall, there were Asian split down into Japanese, Chinese, and maybe Korean, and there were American blacks, and there were Hispanics, Caribbean and Mexican and, I don't know, several brands. And there were Native American and Pacific Islander, which included Filipino and people like that. And then you go down the form and we were supposed to check what we were. And we looked and there was other. That was us. So it's kind of a new thing to live in Oakland. Our daughter Kathy's best friend is named Kristen, which is a nice, I guess, Scandinavian name, except her family name is Katsumata, and her father is Japanese in background. Her mother, the mother of the girl, is Chinese in background, and a very good friend of our other daughter was named Sarah Alamillo, and comes from a Hispanic family. So it's been a kind of a cultural rebirth for our family, moving into an area like that, and working in a state which is rapidly becoming almost majority people of color. The Los Angeles area already, in the public schools, for example, kindergartners, the majority of them speak Spanish as their first language. In the county of Los Angeles. So it's a quite different kind of environment from what we were used to in Michigan or in Iowa, where I lived for 2 years and worked at Grandview College in Des Moines. Quite a different kind of environment for us. And then to work at Pacific Lutheran Seminary, which is made as kind of a goal for itself in the last 5-6 years, to try to convert its form of education into a process and a way of doing theology that is truly multicultural. So we have what's called a Center for Multicultural Ministry, the director of which is Dr. Edmund Yi, who is Chinese in background and a graduate of PLTS and the University of California. We now require of our Master of Divinity students, our seminarians who are aiming at ordination, that they take a course called People of Color, which is taught by Ed Yi, Will Hertzfeldt, who has a German name, but he's black, and Ramona Rank, who is a Klamath Indian from Klamath Falls, some of you may know her, and Sam Hernandez, who is consultant for Hispanic ministry in the South Pacific District of the ALC. So in a way, we have been pulled as a family, and I have been pulled as a person into a new way of trying to think about the church and to do theology in this kind of environment that we live in. Trying to figure out how to relate the Lutheran tradition to God's mission in a very pluralistic, rainbow kind of world. And so that's the kind of topic that I'm going to deal with tonight. And I thought I would start by reading what may be an appropriate passage from St. Paul. And since some of us have been listening to Lee Griffin the last several days, and Lee was talking about visual types and auditory types, some people hear better and others see better, I've given us some visuals along with my words. And you can use your best side of your brains. This is what Paul says. From now on, we regard no one from a human point of view, even though we once regarded Christ from a human point of view, we regard him thus no longer. So if anyone is in Christ, there is a new world. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. So, we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. We beseech you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Working together with him, then, we entreat you not to accept the grace of God in vain. For he says, at the acceptable time I have listened to you and helped you on the day of salvation. Behold, now is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. We put no obstacle in anyone's way so that no fault may be found with our ministry. When we think about trying to move from a kind of obsession with tradition to a compulsion to fulfill God's mission, there are some obstacles to our doing that. And some of those obstacles, some of us heard listening to Lee Griffin, were in a particularly difficult, traumatic, cataclysmic period in human history. Some have spoken about a period of social demoralization. You remember Lee Griffin the other day spoke about the loss of innocence in America, the sense that we were the pure ones who could be assured that we were leading people on the right path throughout the world was shattered by the Vietnam War and Watergate and everything that followed. And with it, a loss of optimism and also a confusion about our identity that followed from it. I was struck this morning listening to Bill Rice when he described culture as having three parts to it. Material culture, the kind of things, the trappings of life, the kind of chairs we sit on and the tools we work with and the clothes we wear, the material culture. Then the social, political, economic culture, the great systems that we use to form the fabric of our social life. And thirdly, he talked about the meanings in culture, which shape our whole vision of the world around us. And it occurred to me that if you look at a list of things that are in our problems for us in our day, they touch on every part of what it is to be a part of our culture. The material, the social, economic, political structures, and the fabric of meanings which are designed to hold us together and shape our vision of the world. The traditional values that seem to be stable through many centuries have broken down since the Second World War with increasing rapidity. The loss of a sense of community, alienation between groups, jockeying for positions of power. We've experienced that in our own, within the last decade. The growth of huge bureaucracies, government, business, medical industry, education itself, makes people feel powerless, and the objects, the victims of powers beyond their control. So that some have said that when Paul used to speak of principalities and powers in our days, that means these huge bureaucracies that dominate and seem to control our lives. And then there's the insistent voice of those representing so many races and so many ethnic groups saying that we have not been treated to the full share of the American pie. And those around the rest of the world have said, you've eaten pie because you've taken it off our backs. And we hear that kind of message insistently, and it's disturbing to us. And then there are the cries of many sorts for economic and social justice coming from the poor, coming from disenfranchised women, and many different groups who are never ending in the message to us that something has to be done to give us a fair shake within the American system. The environmental crisis that makes it seem as though if we continue the style of life to which we've become accustomed, that not only our nation, but even the world cannot long survive. And you'll find over in the bookstore the Global 2000 report that gives the startling and very disturbing data about the likelihood of some kind of disaster if we don't radically change our lifestyle. And then, of course, the ominous umbrella that goes over all of them, and a mushroom-shaped umbrella of the nuclear threat that is frightening and really has begun to absorb and almost paralyze people throughout the world. The result of this pattern of breakdown of so much in our common life over the last number of years has led to a sense of powerlessness and paralysis, so that sociologists asking people questions about how they feel in the world today respond to a statement such as a citizen of such and such a city, or a citizen of such and such a state, or as a citizen of the United States, I am able to do such and such. Well, they find they are not able. People increasingly say, I am not able to be sure I'm going to be able to provide food and housing for my family, quality education, a healthy environment, good medical care, safety on the streets. You should see the referenda that have just passed in the state of California by people who are afraid of the rising crime, and so they want to clamp down hard, and some really horrendous referenda were just passed in the last election about a week ago, getting rid of bail for a lot of people and a very repressive response that came out of the fear that they have for their own safety. Finding a good job. Come out with a college education and you were supposed to be able to go out and get a great job, and now I've talked to some folks here at Holden who on staff who say they've graduated from college and it's very difficult to find something. And partly Holden is a holding place where they are looking for brighter days. Trusting elected officials. Kind of alienation and cynicism about people who are alleged leaders. The incapacity to influence government policy doesn't make any difference. I'll make no difference. Or to control our technology. So there's a sense of powerlessness that infects our whole culture. And when people feel powerless, it's very difficult to have the courage or the feeling of compassion that would produce change. We heard from Lee the response that people will have is to pull back into the past and to try to recover what they feel is being lost. Now, the Lutheran churches in America are trying to respond in a positive and a productive way to all these problems. And I think that we agree that they're probably doing a reasonably good job at the national or church-wide and at the regional level. So there are things going on among the national, the ALC, the LCA, the AELC, the LCMS, Missouri Synod, that are attempts to respond to all this. For example, there's a kind of a lobby that's maintained by the Lutheran Council in Washington, D.C., that brings the voice of the Lutherans in America to bear on public policy issues. There are social statements put out by our various churches that attempt to interpret and become a kind of common voice that will help us to interpret what's happening to us. Similarly, there are educational resources published by our various publishing houses, both for the general public and also for our curriculum. At the regional and local level, there are things happening. We know about the work of Lutheran Social Services. They're increasingly burdened as Reaganomics cuts off federal aid to programs that we know are designed to be helpful to people in need. Many synods and districts pass resolutions which become a voice of Christians in that area are responding to issues like government involvement in the war in El Salvador, the policy toward Namibia, and I'm sure that if any of you have been delegates, you've been a part of discussion that's led to the passing of such resolutions. Many local churches are parts of ecumenical councils which act together for Christians in a local area to try to respond to social and socioeconomic issues. When we come to congregations, it becomes a little different story. And I think that's where the challenge really is. I put a big question down there by congregation. Because congregations, it seemed to me, are feeling the weight of the conflict prompted by the problems of our day in a way that the church-wide agencies and representatives may not have to feel it. Here is where we are. This is where we daily, weekly experience the church, in the local congregation. It seems to me that there are two opposing images of the church that are vying for our allegiance in this period of time, this period of history. And the first is that which, it seems to me, sees the church largely out of its past tradition. Here is where the church is a kind of an anchor. The sea may toss and throw us back and forth, but if only the church can be that anchor that holds us in place so we don't get dashed against the rocks. The church is our rootage. The roots go deep, and no matter how the winds blow or the snows come, the tree will not topple. And we can be secure and safe with that kind of rootage. The church is a rock. solid as the rock of Gibraltar. It's not going to be moved by the cataclysms of our time. And with that, the church is a possession, something I can own, something I've inherited from my parents, my ancestors, my forebears, and it is mine. They can take a lot away from me, but they can't take the church away. And I think there's a feeling like that that goes on for many of us. And finally, the church is my tribe. It's with the people that are like me, the people that I feel comfortable with. It's the group, after all, I was born into. And that is a common pattern for entry into the Lutheran Church, is you're born into it. I was, and my guess is that a good number of you were too. So that's one whole way of looking at the church, which it seems to me is backward-looking and seeks to find security in the rootages in the past. And you remember Lee Griffin said, we need that. That's the pathos of our time. We need that. And yet there's another image of the church that competes for our allegiance. There's the church as a sail, driving the ship along through the waves, leading it to some destination. How about the church as a seed? Not as a rootage, but as a seed of something new. It is inseminating the world. It is turning the world into a garden. It is looking towards future growth and future fruits. Or the church is a wave, not as a rock, but as a wave, moving along and alive and bringing all kinds of things up onto the beach and moistening the ground around it. The church, instead of a possession, as a gift, something that I didn't earn. Maybe I was born into it, but I didn't earn it. I don't have claims to it. It was something that I just got somehow. And so it's not really, in a sense, mine. It's a bequest to me for which I'm grateful. Not the church so much as a tribe as the church as maybe a crew, a group of people who sign up to go on a trip, who set the sails going, and who ride the waves in some future direction. So it seems to me that this other view of the church is trying to look at the church as moving towards something, not looking backwards all the time for rootage, but looking forward to some destination, somewhere that it's believed God may be leading us. It's hard to go off on a voyage, though, when you feel oppressed by all the problems of the modern day. And that's the dilemma that I think we feel in the Lutheran Church. By talking about the immigrant captivity of the Lutheran Church, I'm referring to the, I think, fact that we as Lutherans in America have also a special problem that many other Christians don't have, in that we have a very, very strong ethnic identification. And I guess I haven't felt it as strongly as here at Holden Village the last several days. I'd like to try just a little experiment. I'd like all of you to stand for a second. I want to try something, and maybe this will be sort of embarrassing, but we're all friends. And I'm going to stand too. And let me just try a little something here. How about it if any of you who would call yourself, if somebody asked you what your background is, would say, I'm Finnish, if you would sit down. How about any of you who would say, I am Danish? How about you sit down? Reminds me of my Grandview days. Okay? How about if we said, any of you who are German background, sit down. Okay, let's try any of you who are Swedish background, sit down. Let's try any of you who are Slovak background. Can't forget the Slovak. I almost did. Okay, any of you who are Norwegian background, sit down. Okay, now of those of you who are still standing, if you are Lutheran because you married a Lutheran, sit down. There are how many left? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. About 6 or 7 or 8, maybe. 9, 10, 11. There's a few more. Okay, anyway. There may be a few non-Lutherans in the group. Okay. I think it does illustrate my point, which is that when Lutherans get together, out come the Norwegian jokes. Or out come the German jokes, not so many, but or out come the Swedish jokes. Germans have a harder time laughing about themselves.
They are very sober people.
Okay. And that is a problem only if you don't live in Minnesota or Iowa, or maybe Illinois, or some of the places where there are so many of us who are like us that, you know, the people flock in and out and it seems like this is the way the world is. If you live in California, or parts of Texas, or let's say New York City, many of the urban areas, try Seattle, it is awkward that so many of us represent that narrow band of ethnic groups. And the result for us is that it produces among us as a particular community a particular slant on the world that has a lot more to do with our ethnicity than it does with our understanding of the gospel. And to illustrate that, I want to pass out to you a little sheet that was worked up by the bishop. The bishop speaks. This is of a bishop of the Pacific Southwest Synod of the Lutheran Church in America, Stan Olson, who happens to be, by the way, Mary Olson's father, head of the kitchen staff here. And Stan has to deal with a synod of the church, which is spread over a vast land area, including Arizona, Utah, Nevada, California, Hawaii, did I get it all? Nevada, California, yeah, Arizona, Utah, Hawaii, with many, many, many types of Lutheran, of people. And you'll find that there aren't very many big Lutheran churches in the Pacific Southwest Synod. Well, he wondered why that might be, and he decided that he would like to write a book someday, that, and he's provided some chapter titles. Maybe you better take about one every other person or we're not going to make it with these. In my natural modesty, I didn't provide enough for everybody. Hope there's enough to get, let me keep one. Enough so everybody can at least see one if you got good eyes. If you're like me, you need to hold it here anyway. And he says here, at a recent gathering of Western regional campus pastors, I gave some additional thought to a familiar subject, indigenization. That is, how do you get the church to seem to fit with the local folks instead of a foreign import? How do you make it look local instead of like a foreign import? My premise is that immigrant people have a strong tendency to codify all that they bring from the homeland. Language, customs, recipes, and religion all have a hard time changing. The resulting captivity is more pervasive than anything Gibson Winter ever dreamed of in his book, The Suburban Captivity of the Church, some of you may have read. Let me share with you some chapters and lead thoughts on a book that might be called The Immigrant Lutheran Captivity of the Church. After you've read my outline, you may have a few chapters of your own you'd like to add. It'd be interesting to see. Might look down through that, and I want to ask you as you read through the chapters that Stan has listed, does this ring true for you? of the Lutheran communities that you experience? Do you experience them as captivities? Or do they seem to you like, gee, that's why I'm there? You know, like the Lutheran church I was a member of in Des Moines, Luther Memorial Church. It's an old Danish church, and the folks love to dance around the Christmas tree at Christmas. That was an old Danish custom. And when they had a sandwich supper, they would put in the bulletin, there'll be a sandwich supper, and you should bring your sandwiches along. So Judy brought the sandwiches, you know, the peanut butter on Wonder Bread or whatever it was, I don't know, We discovered sandwich supper meant specialty Danish sandwiches with all these curly little meats on them. And they didn't tell us that, but that was just assumed as the way we do things. So anyway, if you do experience some of this stuff, do you experience it as captivity or do you experience it as a good thing, something you really like? And then, are there other captivities that Stan hasn't thought of? I'd like to hear from you about some of this, and then we'll talk about how do we get liberation from it to the extent that it is a captivity or a set of captivities. First of all, does this stuff ring true for you? Share with us a little that would illustrate it, if you've got something to illustrate, from your home congregation.
From our church, the last two or three years, they've had a Lutheran feast.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of Scandinavians, they're both Norwegians and Swedes. But they're very open. Now, it started out as a joke. We're going to have a sauerkraut feast. And now... We get people coming to us, when are we going to have that sauerkraut and service? So they're open to it.
Uh-huh. Isn't lutefisk, eating lutefisk, sort of a hazing? initiation rite? Don't they make the kids eat it at confirmation or something like that? That's all it is then, if you survive, you're a Lutheran.
Well, I came into the Lutheran Church at 25, and it interested me. For instance, I came into something that had Ozzy Hoffman, Fight for the Nations, and cover. Well, we were sitting over in England, and they sent out the church calendar, Bring Fight for the Nations, what did it show? Ozzy Hoffman shaking hands with the President of the United States. And I think, coming in from the outside into the church, and perhaps, as you say, the immigrant side of it, if anyone makes it on the national scene, boy, that's really big.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I came out of a long English sort of stuff, and nobody ever thought it's a press, you know, it's something like that.
Yeah.
But I think we are a Lutheran, very conscious. Boy, if we got a Lutheran governor, you know, or Edward Meese III, you know, mm-hmm. for good or bad, the advice of the president, he is a Lutheran church in the birth and is Lutheran, you know. And I think we are sort of, that's a side to us, too, still.
On the one hand, we're very self-conscious about being Lutheran, more so than most Christians are about their particular tradition. We talk about being Lutheran more than most other Christians talk about being Methodist or Presbyterian or whatever. So that's one side of what you're saying. And the other is that Lutherans have tended to be somewhat separate from the society as a group and to pride themselves almost on it. We're a little different, we like to say. And so when somebody does sort of make it in public life, it's a big thing for us because it's so rare.
A corollary to that, I think, is so neat. If other people maybe social mobility and they go up the social ladder, you know, and all of a sudden you find somebody turning into being an Episcopalian, you were a Baptist or something.
Mm-hmm.
But Lutherans are terrific, the statistics show. I mean, no matter what happens to them, they stay Lutheran because their faith is more important than that convenient sort of image.
We're very loyal.
Really, yeah.
We're very well bonded to this group.
The question is that faith?
Yeah.
Yeah, are we bonded to the faith, or are we bonded to the distinctive cultural community? I guess that's the question.
I don't mind dovetailing on that, but it seems to me that the real negative part of it is just simply saying, I'm Lutheran. And I really have no concept of what it means to be a Lutheran, but I'm Lutheran, and my mother was Lutheran, and my grandfather and mother was Lutheran, and I they came from Norway, and on and on. Mm-hmm. I think that's a real negative. But I think to affirm the rich theological heritage that we have, that is, I mean, to really understand what Luther was saying, to get at that as Lutherans, mm-hmm. I think that's a very powerful thing. Now, it doesn't seem we're doing that at the church, but I think that's the kind of thing we have to be doing.
The pathos of what you're saying is that if we do have a message which is really exciting and something that we believe we'd like to share, the pathos is if we're damaged in our capacity to share it because it comes across communicated in ways that seem quite alien to people that we want to share it with. And that's a problem that we experience particularly in places like California. Yeah.
And if you want people to change, you know, I've been a Lutheran for what? Probably 8 weeks. And when I say I don't like the song in the liturgy, or I think they ought to make an adjustment in the liturgy someplace, boy, you think I was, they want to stone me or something.
I don't think so. I think you're really Lutheran already.
Yeah.
There is,
Lutheran student movement. I finally got Roman Catholic Irish Roman Catholic to come to it, who was kind of looking for a new way of seeing God, and I was so excited he was coming, and I said, this is a good place. And after the first night, I was so embarrassed because the whole opening was, you know, we're the mighty Lutherans, or what, Lutherans, Lefta, we're the mighty Lutherans, you betcha. And the whole night, I was trying to listen to the night thing through his eyes, and he didn't know what this was all about. Is that what Lutheranism is?
It's hard for us, I think, to imagine what it's like if you're a Chinese Lutheran, for example. There are a number of Chinese congregations in the Bay Area, San Francisco area, and in Los Angeles area, or Hispanic Lutheran, and then to go to a convention or to a youth gathering. I heard from it's Pastor Bill Ruth, who's in Baldwin Park, California, and he really had to work to get the kids from his congregation who are of Hispanic background to go to a sort of a youth convo. And so they went to the youth convo, and somehow, I don't know why, they were having a kind of a what do you call this thing that hangs from the ceiling, and a pinata thing that they were going to bang and the candy would come out, except the pinata was a papier-mâché statue of a sort of Frito Bandito. And here were all these blonde-haired boys and girls beating this Frito Bandito to get the candy out of him. And here were these kids from Baldwin Park just absolutely shocked by what they saw. Or take the kids from St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Los Angeles, which is about a 99% black congregation. Again, those kids go to a youth convo, and they're maybe the only black kids there, and feel that they're being shunned by the other kids. Of course, kids at that age aren't, it's hard for them to reach out to people that aren't like themselves. That's the developmental task of adolescence, to fit into their own group. And so the black kids don't fit. It's very hard for them. Now, I don't know, you know, what is the solution when this is the church we've got. But if we want to be inclusive of all of God's children in this country, it is our dilemma as the kind of that comes out of our own tradition. Let's see. Are there other captivities that you don't see here that you think ought to have been there? Yeah.
Well, Well, I don't know what people would think, but I have a feeling that a lot of Lutheran churches are very, or are perhaps more unfriendly or less friendly than some of the, perhaps than some of the other Protestant churches I have been at. And could that, well, first of all, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I see that to some extent.
No doubt it varies from congregation to congregation, but it may be that Lutherans tend, because of their ethnic background, to be more reserved. Is that possible? And so they appear to be unfriendly. That could be. Okay, anything else?
I think there appear is a key word there.
Right, right. I'm not passing judgment on it. They may pass off signals to people that are read as unfriendliness.
The captivity of Suffragettes.
I think that yes. Lutherans tend to be very, very comfortable with their own little middle-class group. Mm-hmm. And they don't go out, like our minister says, we're so comfortable here. We're neither rich nor poor. There's nobody black, nobody of different color in our church, and they're all around us, but we're not getting them in. Because they're very happy and comfortable.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is something you have to look at. We were all through a congregation in Portland, Oregon, and I know that in the past we were considered to be a very cold congregation, but I think we've become, we're on fire for Christ, and that has made a difference. And now we've taken in Laotian family, not too long ago, 11 members of the Laotian family were baptized, and our pastor learned enough of their language to baptize them in the Laotian language, and it was the most moving thing you have ever seen. And now there's an entirely different atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the change can occur with the right set of. Okay. Yes.
I'm from Indiana, and we're from a large congregation there. And we had used the Bethel program along with the Feeding Ministry and outreach programs where I think we're getting a lot closer. Our congregation is quite 2,000 members. And on a Sunday morning, they're really stressing us, and I can see it in the last 5 years. And it really helps.
So new people who don't represent those typical Lutheran ethnic groups are coming into your congregation. Okay, well, the implications of what we've been talking about relate to the whole question of how culture affects the way that we act in our society. And you could say that the way that we act in the world is dependent on how we understand the world, and how we understand the world is dependent on what we notice about the world, and what we notice is dependent on what we see when we look around us. Bill Rice is talking about this somewhat today, and that is what they discover is that human beings, unlike every other animal, respond to stimuli not directly but indirectly. That is, you cannot predict exactly how people are going to respond to given stimuli, because in between the stimuli and the response comes the image or the meaning, the meaning given to the stimuli by the human person. And the meanings that we give to what occurs to us or what happens to us is filtered by the culture out of which we come. So we as Lutherans come out of a culture that acts as a filter on the ways that we understand the world around us, and then in turn affect how we act. We see, what do we see when we look around here? I was saying I looked around Holden Village, and what if we did a kind of a darkness indicator, pigmentation indicator, and on a 1 to 10 scale, 10 being black and one being white, albino, I said, gee, we're about a 2. So we don't even have to notice. I mean, just look, and we've got one spectrum of the world population to affect our activities. The future impact of a more inclusive church will be that as we begin to talk and be stimulated by people who are quite different from ourselves, the way we view the world will change and the way we act is going to change too. That's the sort of kind of stuff that's happened to a lot of us that have moved into environments that are very diverse, very pluralistic. Well, how do we get there? I'm going to rely here on some stuff put together by a theologian from Yale, Letty Russell, who has written a couple of books on partnership. One of her books is in the bookstore here. I think it's called The Growth in Partnership or something like that. This is from a later book of hers, which also deals with partnership. And she talks about the old math and the new math in understanding the world. And I understand what she means by old math to be tradition, and what she understands by new math to be mission. The old math is the kind of math that sees everything on a ledger, and you've got debits and you've got credits, right? Okay, I don't know much about the old or the new. Okay, so you got the ledger book, and you've got stuff coming in and going out all the time, and it's a very kind of brass tacks math. The new math, she says, is God's math of abundance, of generosity, of grace, of fullness. And she compares the two in this way. She says, typical of the old math is that people are in future shock. They feel maladjusted in the world today because they look to the past with nostalgia as a golden age they wish they could return to. It's a special problem, she says, for religious groups and for professional theologians who depend so heavily on the past for the interpretations that they give to life, unlike many of the secular futurists who really look ahead for the meanings that they impart to life. These are people who experience future shock are those that are disoriented whenever change occurs because it threatens the security that they feel in past experience. They really want to be able to control the world, which is viewed as a kind of a static, fixed thing that we want to have stay that way. The past is needed as an anchor. We can't know who we are unless we know who we've been. That's true. But who we've been is not totally who we are or who we will be. So that's a problem for those folks. And the past can therefore be a captivity. So future shock is typical of the old math, says Letty Russell. Another characteristic is the concentration on my thing, ownership, holding on, hoarding, being careful not to dissipate our resources because we'll never get them back. Once it's gone, we'll have nothing. We talk about my spouse, my toy, my car, my church, and don't invade my turf. That is the my thing kind of stuff that comes out of the old math. Everybody who comes towards one of my possessions threatens that because they may take it away and I won't have it anymore. Another characteristic, she says, is circumference. That is, we define our relationships by constructing boundaries around them. We know who gets into the corral, inside the fort, inside the fortress. What an unfortunate name for a publishing house. The chosen ones fit inside the circumference. They're the special ones, different from everybody else, and we better make sure that we don't spoil what we've got by letting people across from the outside. Outsiders are a threat. We define ourselves by contrast with those outside the parameters of our corral. She says another typical characteristic is we work from subtraction tables. We have a quantitative worldview. If you win, I lose. So I better be careful to see you don't win too much. You are, in other words, in competition with me for the good things of life, and I better be careful that I don't lose them to you. Even love we can't give away, because if I share it too widely, it's gonna be gone, dissipated. Superiority factor. She's trying to use this kind of math image. Superiority factor, a kind of lack of humility. We grade ourselves, we attribute our self-worth by grading ourselves over against others. We Lutherans are the best. We're better than all other Christians. We're particularly better than certain other Christians. And our identity is fortified by our certainty that we are the best. We enhance our own authority, our power, our prestige at the expense of others when we operate out of the superiority factor. Clergy expand themselves at the expense of laity. Lutherans at the expense of non-Lutherans. Okay, permanent inequality is a characteristic of the old math. In that fixed system, there's a fixed social structure of dominance and of subordination. Which runs along the levels of race, of sex, of status, in all the different areas of clergy and laity. That's a problem. So the sheep says that what the Christian church ought to represent is not the old logic of equivalence, one-to-one, you deduct here when you add over here, but a new logic of excess, of generosity, of life in its fullness, of superabundance. It's what we call grace. Grace. And people who experience and live the new math, they don't have future shock, they have what she calls Advent shock. This means they don't feel comfortable in the present world, not because they're nostalgic for the past, but because they are eager and hopeful for the arrival of a longed-for future. They're looking ahead. And they wish it would get here. And so they stop responding to the world from the human point of view, says Paul. They are restless and uneasy and impatient about what they see going on in the world around them. Oppression, injustice, pain. They have a dis-ease with all of this, with sexism, with racism, with classism, because they recognize that in the shalom world of the future, those things are no longer to be. How am I going to get through all of this? And the new math when the bell is ringing and the old math?
Yeah.
I'll go quicker. They don't talk about my thing, they talk about a third thing, and that means not mine, not yours, but our shared thing. A koinonia, shared task, a common partnership. Instead of defining themselves from the borders or from who they keep out, they define themselves from the center, which is Christ. Every partnership is formed around a center, a basis of commitment, a source of strength and identity, and for us that's shaped at our baptism in the name of Jesus and is shaped by the story of Israel and of Jesus himself. Instead of subtraction tables, we go by multiplication tables. Love multiplies when it's shared. It's like the multiplication of the loaves and fishes. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. One person plus another person doesn't equal one, or even two, it equals three, because you've created a relationship which is a new thing, beyond and transcendent of the two parts that make up the relationship. That's what's going to happen when we merge the ALC, the LCA, and the AELC. It's going to be more than three coming together. It's going to be a new thing that transcends all of that. And so it'll be with an inclusive church. Instead of a superiority factor, Letty Russell talks about a minus factor, calculated inefficiency, where those that feel that they are strong pull back to allow the strengths of others to shine. Space for growth, the gifts of each valued and identified so that everybody can participate and share from their wealth. And permanent inequality is replaced by temporary inequality. That is, the inequality that comes because each of us is willing to serve the others. and therefore we're willing to put ourselves under others at the points where our gifts need to be shared in that way. She says that when she goes to a conference and she's the reason they're there, her husband is Mr. Russell. And when she goes to a conference where he's the reason they're there, she becomes Mrs. Hokendyke. God is already treating us according to the new math. I'm winding up now. God is already treating us according to the new math, whether we operate on those grounds or not, and has already called us into that partnership, that koinonia, where we are tonight, a partnership grounded in the math of abundance and grace. And that is the ground for our hope, for the politics of our hope, which wants us to be surprised by the future and to seek after God's surprises, so that even we Lutherans can become no longer immigrants looking for a romantic past that lies behind, but sojourners together with Asians, with blacks, with Hispanics, with Native Americans, with Pacific Islanders, looking with eager anticipation for the fullness of God's new world. Thanks. Tomorrow night we're going to talk about images of the church under the title, Ghosts or Monsters.
Good morning.